This is part two of the very interesting discussion arranged by Yes4EU concerning food and agricultural standards post-Brexit and whether we can maintain them. We rejoin the meeting just as Dr. Alison Pollock is about to speak.
Thanks. Sorry, I can't see the screen for some reason. The screen share has gone off. Thank you for inviting me. I think I probably don't have very much to say about... I suppose there are three aspects to this. There's the domestic policies and what the government is actually pursuing, because they're quite instrumental in determining both Brexit and any US trade deal that is done. And I think it's really important to look at what's happening domestically. And one of the issues about COVID is the way in which we've seen a massive deregulation going on. And my area of expertise is health, but it's happening. You can see it with education. You can see it in every sphere. And I'm really concerned about the powers, actually, the UK government and all the governments have taken on to deal with the COVID pandemic. And I think that needs to be watched very carefully. Because the one thing that COVID has done is highlighted our vulnerabilities. It's highlighted how ill-prepared the UK government, and I include all the four nations in this, were for COVID. The lack of action on travel, on quarantine, the extraordinary delays, and the fact that the health services were reduced to an emergency COVID service and still are pretty much, although they're beginning to get going. But that has resulted in catastrophic delays for many people, and we will see a backlog in waiting lists. And of course, I don't need to bring home to you what's actually happened in nursing care, where Scotland, as much as England, has been absolutely disastrous in their handling of social care and older people. And I'm very concerned that part of the response of the UK government has been a knee-jerk reaction instead of doing an analysis of why we were so ill-prepared in the NHS and rebuilding capacity that has been lost and eroded, that a lot of money has been proven to be. And which may well end up with the government having even more problems later down the line. And I'll touch on two or three of these. One is the Nightingale Hospitals, which was a UK approach, and of course have lain empty, but they've cost many, many millions and we haven't seen the contract for those. The second is the approach to building a commercial diagnostics industry instead of reinvesting in NHS laboratories. The third is the extraordinary time that was waited on an NHS app, which you all know about. And the amount of money that's been thrown at private sector providers, the hospitals, both in Scotland and also social care, without thinking about what kind of society we want to live, what are our values, what are our principles, and how should that care be organised. Now, I can understand people being in a panic in the early stages, but we're now 4 months into an epidemic, and I'm still not confident that we've got the right measures in place, but also that we've got the right domestic policies. And the reason why these domestic policies are so important is because they determine the extent to which we're exposed from Brexit, post-Brexit, but also to US trade deals. Because the more we've liberalized and opened up our public services, the less room that we have to negotiate. And I did work with colleagues actually in 2000, so this is now 20 years ago, on the World Trade Organization and the GATS, which showed the way in which the UK government had failed to protect hospital services from being opened up. So I think this is really, really important that we need to look much more closely at our domestic policies and also our taxation policies. I know Jim was saying how wonderful the Scottish food and alcohol industry is, but how much of those taxes are actually returning into the public purse, and how much is actually being sheltered through big global multinational corporations? That would be a question to answer. And the same with our pharmaceutical industry as well, and the diagnostics industry. We've been part of the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, but that we've seen a lot of deregulation going on of medicines and diagnostics, with the desire to open a market rather than protecting public health. So I don't intend to speak very long because you've had a lot of speakers, but I would just urge everybody to look very carefully at the framing of the domestic policies. We still have horrible policies like the Private Finance Initiative, but also Scottish Futures Trust, where though the UK government threw a lot of money at the health service to write off the debts of hospitals, say in England, but that will also have impacted on the Scottish budget. It hasn't done anything about opening up these contracts on roads, on schools, where we're paying exorbitant amounts of interest. I mean, interest rates have never been so low, they're almost into negative figures. And yet on these PFI contracts, we're paying enormous sums of money, anything from 5 to 15% interest rates, and that's without the returns on equity being factored in. And yet we have had no analysis or conversation about where money is going and how it's being spent. We also have contracts now being awarded without going out to tender. We've seen that specifically, I've seen it in health and social care. And those contracts have not been published, so we don't know whether they're value for money. And the NAO has already raised serious concerns, but this will be too late down the line. So I'm very concerned about the extraordinary powers that the government has at the moment, the lack of accountability, both fiscal and public, and the public accountability for how our money is spent, and to make sure it's good value and where the money is actually going. You're absolutely right. We're in for a major, major recession. And it's the young people who will suffer most. It's the young people who have been sacrificed in this epidemic, although they were least at risk. The young people who have been failed in not having their schooling and their education. I think we could and must do an awful lot better. This epidemic has exposed all our vulnerabilities, why we need each other, our vulnerability to illness, why we need health and social care, why we need public services, why we need safety nets, why we need support. It's also exposed the huge inequalities in our society between rich and poor, which are widening. And also, of course, the social deprivation, the effect on Black and ethnic minority groups, but especially on older people, because older people have borne the brunt with the excess deaths. We have an issue already with our domestic policies in that, unlike many countries in Europe, we've deregulated our workforce hugely. It's absolutely abysmal that a quarter of our social care workers, we have about 1.6 million throughout the UK, about 250,000 in Scotland, they're on extremely low pay and they're on 0-hour contracts. So my feeling is, if we're going to be really serious about talking about anything, we have to look at the mote in our own eye and start with our domestic policies and identify the extent to which we've already gone down the road to huge deregulation. Of course, we could get a workforce in agriculture and on farms. There's plenty of unemployed people and who are being furloughed, but the issue is their terms and conditions, and their pay and their living conditions and their training. And that's no different from the social care workforce. So I'm not taking either a nationalist or a pro-Europe or anything bent, but I do think that we've got a lot to learn from Europe. We have a lot, European countries have handled this pandemic much, much better than the UK. And that's partly because they realize the importance of public services and the fiscal safety net. We've congratulated our Treasury on its actions around furloughing. but that's going to come to an end. And I think the Institute for Fiscal Studies has already published data to show we've been less generous than other countries. So I can't stress enough that I think we really need to decide what kind of society we want to live in, what the principles are, and the organizing framework, and really look much more closely at domestic policies. The Scottish Government's done lots of good things, but it could do much better. It's had a commitment to human rights, but those rights have been severely eroded through the epidemic. And those rights have been particularly eroded for older people, people with disabilities, people with mental health problems. And indeed, their rights have been reduced to the sort of basic necessary for life rather than compatible with human rights. And we have a First Minister who's completely committed to human rights. And yet we've seen the erosion of those rights during this pandemic. So I feel I've gone on enough, but it's always the domestic policies that leave us open to deregulation and to trade agreements, because we haven't taken enough care to protect, whether it be our sale of goods or our services or the quality of food or the agriculture. If we haven't taken the necessary measures, then we leave ourselves extremely exposed. And Europe has done a lot to try and put in protective measures around health, around food, around the environment. And we are going to be weaker without that collective voice for support. Anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we've got some questions.
Yes, again, we have lots of questions. So from the Q&A, what will be the impact of health if we leave the transition period during another spike of COVID-19? So basically, if we're in a spike of COVID-19 come January, what effects will we see from that?
For what? Because of the transition?
If we leave the transition,
effects will be because of government action and having taken the necessary steps to protect its population if we're in a second spike. Of course, there are lots of concerns about medicines, about drugs, about vaccines, and the pricing agreements, etc. And they're of course important considerations, but I can't second guess what's actually going on.
We have a question saying, what lessons should we draw from the UK government's approach to the corona crisis about how they approach the post-Brexit crisis after the 31st of December 2020? So we're talking about the UK government now and what, you know, the way they've handled things and what how they treat their people.
Yes, I mean, I think the UK government's performance has been absolutely abysmal, and it has resulted, there is no doubt, in many excess deaths from COVID, but also non-COVID. And the government, UK government is only, and the Scottish government, we must actually look at all the deaths that are occurring because of non-COVID. So it's been absolutely abysmal. The Scottish government for far too long went along with the UK government, and I don't know why it did that, but maybe there was a financial incentive to do so. I have to contrast it with Wales, which did its own thing around testing, for example. I'm very apprehensive. I don't think we have a functioning, competent government at the moment. And it's very frightening. We are seeing a lot of money now being parcelled out through contracts which haven't gone formally to tender, where there is no doubt that you know, many of these will subsequently be shown to be not value for money and a waste of public money. So I'm very, very apprehensive about the current negotiations and the future negotiations.
So we have a question that was sent in beforehand. It says, Nicola Sturgeon has said she cannot rule out introducing quarantine or screening for travellers coming from England if infection rates rise south of the border. Do you think that closing the border with England would help eliminate the COVID virus in Scotland? That's a controversial question.
Yes, I think it's really interesting. I mean, we have a pandemic. So every country has COVID. So the question is, why did we not introduce quarantine and travel restrictions back in February? We knew what was happening and we didn't. And the UK government, including the Scottish government, were almost unique in not offering, in not having any travel or quarantine restrictions. So we're only doing it 4 months into it. It's regrettable, but we're now seeing in England, probably more local lockdowns are going to be happening. So you may end up having travel restrictions and quarantine. That's difficult to know whether the government could actually impose that.
From a health point of view, because obviously in Scotland, I mean, what the big question of the day is, in Scotland, we're actually managing to get, at the moment anyway, the levels of the virus in the community down, which, yeah. You know, you were saying about the elderly, especially in that, you know, we all have elderly parents who are desperate to come out. So from that point of view, you know, if we can get the virus down, then we are reversing the bad things that were done in the first place, maybe. But with... But if we have an insurge of tourists from England, we could revert, you know, that could cause a lot of local outbreaks very quickly. That's the worry. What do you think from a health point of view that would?
Well, I suppose there are two or three things. One is, have you got a good monitoring system in place? Are you confident that it's working? And have you got a good contact tracing system in place so that when patients present with symptoms, you can get on top of an outbreak? I mean, it's quite complicated because not everybody, some people are much higher risk of spreading and shedding the virus than others. But you can imagine a situation where you might say, we're having a cordon sanitaire because Scotland is now down to no cases or very few cases. So then you would do temperature monitoring and you might do quarantine. You could imagine that situation beginning to happen. Indeed, that made a lot of sense in the Highlands and Islands earlier on, where the Western Isles and Orkney had almost no cases. You could have had a cordon sanitaire operating there, and then that would have allowed the community to go back to school and back to work. So, and as in Germany, you may have a regional approach and regional lockdown measures where you actually restrict mobility in and out. I mean, the whole problem with the government's approach is it's taken a very centralised national approach, and the Scottish government was equally guilty of going along with this. And really, the whole logic of local contact tracing is you would have a regional approach, much more devolved. But that means you've got to have really good local data, really good contact tracing, all the other public health measures like hand washing, etc., in place, and social distancing. And at the same time, you might then have cordon sanitaire around regions where you actually restrict mobility in and out. So it's not impossible that you might say you would have some border controls as you're doing in airports and ports, where they're going to be doing temperature testing. But the big problem is enforcing quarantine and supporting quarantine and monitoring quarantine. Because quarantine means a big sacrifice for the people who are going into quarantine. They need to be supported financially and in their housing. And there needs to be community health monitoring. And I'm not convinced that we have got that right yet.
Right. Do you want to move on to some more general questions? I don't know, are you still there, Jim? Can we get you? Can you hear us? I'm not sure. So we had some other questions for you, Lorna. If we go to the pre-asked questions, actually.
I'm afraid I have another meeting to go to at 8 o'clock, so I've got four minutes right. And then I have to run away. I'm really sorry.
Well, I'll ask the questions that are to you then first.
I tried to start looking through the Q&A to see what I could find, but
there's a lot to do with people saying about Dominic Cummings, but I'm not sure that that's to and that the UK government prioritised business over general health. Is WEA2 the way forward? I had a question actually more general to you about the Medicines Agency, and especially to do with Scottish independence, because obviously that's, you know, the two aims of our group are one to independence and two to join the EU. If we leave the EU, is there anything that we'll notice about our, you know, you sort of touched on it with the COVID, but is there anything that we'll particularly notice about the health and especially research, which is my area of interest, and whether that there'll be a sort of if we diverge from the EU health standards, for example, whether it would be difficult to go back.
Who's that question?
Yes, sorry, for Alison. Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. Gosh, that's quite a difficult one. I mean, the European Medicines Agency has already deregulated, unfortunately, a lot of the pathways for medicines. So in my opinion, when I've looked at the evidence, medicines are being given far too rapid approval without sufficient analysis of the benefits and harms. There's a risk that this will, and of course that this will carry on. It's exactly the same in the US FDA. Many of the medicines that are being approved are extremely expensive, but not with no real benefit, and they're based on something called surrogate outcomes. So we don't have hard outcome measures. So my own feeling is that the whole medicine system needs to be radically looked at, and it's part of what kind of society do we want and how are we going to prioritize our medicines and new medicines, and actually stimulate really meaningful research, because innovation has been taken to mean anything that's new rather than truly innovative and truly making a difference. I think we also need to take a long, hard look at the way in which research is actually funded and how universities are being funded as well to do research. There's a huge amount of waste that happens in research, and partly because of this competitive bidding process, which is very unhealthy, it's very time-wasting, and it doesn't necessarily result in the right questions being asked. But anyway, these are my views so I think, you know, all these things give us an opportunity to think about what kind of society we want and our principles, and especially as we're going to be going into a major recession where redistribution is going to be on people's minds. We have to be thinking very creatively and differently. The danger is that we'll end up just wanting to go back to the old ways and not thinking differently about how we organise ourselves as a society.
I think there was one other question to Alison, sorry, that was sent in, so I'll read that before you have to go. It was from somebody that said, I listened to you and your colleagues at an Independent Sage Zoom meeting last week. And was disappointed to find that the COVID-19 statistics that were presented referred to the situation in the UK, whereas in reality the data was collected in England. The picture is different in Scotland. Why was this not made clear to the audience?
I think that's a very fair point, and I think it's a really good point. And I think it's partly because the real catastrophe that's taking place is in England at the moment. It really is a chaotic, confused mess. But I think that's a very valid point. But of course, if you've got 55 million people in England and things are not working, then of course the dangers for Wales and Scotland are very real with cross-border flows, as one of the earlier questioners asked about quarantine. So I think that's a very fair criticism, and it's one that I will take back to independent stage. It's one that we've made before. And I think there's no excuse for it, really.
Yeah, just on social media, I think it's something that people are frustrated about, that people equate UK with England, where, and it's so, we Scotland need criticism of the governments and need criticism of what's happening here, but we don't get that as much because we get all what's happening elsewhere.
Yes, I mean, maybe you should have an ISA for Scotland, actually.
Do we not have our own independent?
Pardon?
I think that the Scottish government now have an advisory.
But the minutes are very disappointing. The minutes are cursory, and it's not clear. The members of the stage group for the Scottish expert group are also members and give evidence, so they're not really independent. And what you need is critical voices. May not be popular, but they're really necessary, I think, in a democracy, and it's very healthy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we all are part of society, and we all want to contribute to making it better.
So, yeah, so will we move on to questions? Some of the other questions, there was ones for further up that
just to mention that it is 8 o'clock now.
Yes.
So do we want to continue on, or do you want to end here? There's quite a lot more questions, but maybe we could have a few more, or we can finish it here, because we did start quite late. So, I mean, if Alison needs to go, obviously.
I'm fine. I'll stay on for another 5 minutes, but I'm aware that I've hogged all the answers.
That's fine.
So, I think I should go and let you have questions for the other people. And thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for all the wonderful questions. They're very thoughtful.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, bye.
Thank you.
Do we still have Lorna?
Lorna's also left.
Oh, she's had to leave. So we can just
have
a couple more questions to Jim, and then we can finish. So one of them was, could you comment on the announcement from Liz Truss that a new Trade and Agricultural Commission be established, in particular, which bodies be represented in the Commission, and how can the recommendations be adhered to, and how will the Commission relate to Scotland? You need to unmute. Unmute.
Unmute. Got you. Is that better?
Yes.
Right, okay. The commission, as far as I can see from what we know about it, is nothing more than throwing the industry a bone. It has, it's only just been announced. It's going to look at how we keep the food industry strong, but it's advisory, it's time limited. And I think it is purely a method of the UK government stalling criticism until such time as they pursue their trade deals. I know that NFU and NFUS are all saying this is good news, but given the track record of the UK government so far, and given their promises that they have broken time and time again, I think it's nothing more than a fig leaf for an issue that they are trying to wriggle their way through, and I don't think it'll have any jurisdiction, I don't think it'll have any effect, and I think the trade deals will continue along the lines that they've already tried. Liz Truss has already said that what she's trying to do is get tariffs reduced in American agricultural produce in order to smooth the deals. So I have no faith in it whatsoever.
Thank you. Do we want to end there, Sam? Do you want to say thank you to everybody for joining?
Well, yes. Thank you very much, Jim. That was fantastic. Really very, very useful information about supporting Scottish brands and eating Scottish. Unfortunately, Lorna and Alison have already left, so we can't thank them. We'll thank them by email. But thank you, everybody, for watching. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope that we asked most of your questions, and hopefully we'll have more of these webinars coming up very soon. And yeah, please follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and also we have a website. I think the link is in the chat. So thank you very much for joining in and asking brilliant questions, and good night.
Thank you. I have a, sorry, before you, you go question, before you go, Jim, I have a quick question for you. I don't know if anybody's still listening, but it was quite interesting what you were saying about the waiters being the professionals in other countries and, you know, treated like unskilled workers here. And I just wondered whether you thought it was, because I know in France they have not just sort of agricultural colleges, but sort of colleges where people learn, you know, all aspects of the food trade. And I just wondered whether you thought it might be worth Scotland having, you know, to go along with their increased food standards, you know, having an institute for the catering industry, if you like, in that kind of way.
Well, there is one. There's a fantastic one. It's called the Hospitality Industries Trust Scotland. And what they do is they set up scholarships for all forms of hospitality training. And it's actually something that's very close to my heart. My brother passed away in 2019. He was the only 2 Michelin star chef in Scotland. And the Scottish government put finances into Hospitality Industry Trust in order to set up a scholarship in Andy's name because of the fact that he was the only 2 Michelin star chef. He was world renowned. And those kinds of things are already happening. The hospitality industry is a fantastic industry at looking after its own and giving really good training. And I'm going to get a wee plug in here. I'm climbing Kilimanjaro next September in 2021 in order to raise funds for the Cornhill Hospice in Perth and also for the Andrew Fairley Scholarship. So if anybody wants to go into my Virgin Money giving page, please do. But that already exists, but it's something that we need to expand and really appreciate the value of it, because you can't have an industry that is so important to the Scottish economy, but it's still regarded as a low-skilled industry. We really need to start looking at it as a career and as a professional career that people are proud to be a part of.
That's great, thanks. So yeah, thank you very much, and thanks for joining us. And everybody, the other people, there's still 25 people here, so thank you to them as well for staying on and listening to my extra question at the end.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's great. Thank you, everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye.